Music of the evening, usually heard at this time, will not be heard tonight in order that we might bring you this special broadcast.
This is the NBC Newsroom in New York. Tonight we are not interrupting a program to bring you a news bulletin. Tonight we are presenting a special program commemorating 5 years of war, featuring NBC's top news commentators and war correspondents around the world. This is Don Goddard speaking. Listen. You know that familiar NBC signature, the three chimes that ring at the end of every network program on NBC. But have you heard this one? Have you heard that extra chime, the fourth chime? The fourth chime rings only when news is breaking of world importance. When it rings, all of us at NBC spring into action, wherever we may be. The fourth chime means to us, call the office. Get down here. Big things are happening. The fourth chime has been rung many times in the 5 long years of war. It rang most recently when Allied forces stormed the beaches of Normandy on D-Day. It will ring surely one day soon to signal the fall of Germany. It will ring for the Japs. Tonight, we ring it as we look back on the biggest news story of modern times. 5 years of World War II. The men covering the war for NBC today are men who have been eyewitnesses to all the world-shaking events of the past 5 years. Kaltenborn, Jordan, Vandercook, St. John, Chaplin, Beatty, Lochner, and many more. You'll hear from them and from NBC overseas in this half hour, recalling memorable stories of the war and their coverage for NBC. Stories that are part of the big story that rings the fourth chime. Let's begin in 1931, 7 years before Munich. 7 years in which Hitler, Mussolini, and Hirohito perfected their plans to plunge the entire world into the most destructive war of all time. You'll remember those years. Now H.V. Kaltenborn recalls a memorable news story of that era.
It was 1932. Hitler had just passed through one of his emotional crises. Hindenburg had refused to make him chancellor. To distract him, his advisors had arranged interviews with Nazi leaders and foreign correspondents. Thus, I got my chance to see him at Berchtesgaden.
Hey, Hitler. Herr Kaltenborn.
He was in belligerent mood. I angered him further by challenging his anti-Semitism.
Jews are anti-German. Jews are foreigners. They are enemies. You have your Monroe Doctrine, your immigration laws. What is the difference?
He was completely illogical about everything. He denied he wanted absolute power in Germany yet. And this will show you how he twists things to his purpose.
Listen, Herr Kaltenborn. Under the rules of democracy, a majority, 51% of the people, has the right to govern the other 49%. I have 37% of the German voters on my side now. That is 75% of the necessary 51%. Therefore, I should have three-fourths of the power.
I did secure one interesting admission from Hitler in his 1932 interview.
I am the Führer. I am the Nazi Party. The party does not exist without the leader.
Which is more important, Herr Hitler? The personality of the leader or the policies of his party?
Leader and party are identical. No idea can be maintained without a leader.
I put a final question to him. Herr Hitler, how do you expect to follow legal methods in securing power? Do you expect to follow legal methods? His stern face relaxed into something resembling a cynical smile. It meant he would use legal means until he had acquired power. Then, well, you know what happened then. Some men seem to have been put into this world to do evil, to destroy and desecrate that which other men hold dear. I met one of these men that day at Berchtesgaden.
September 29th, 1938. As the world waits breathlessly, Chamberlain, Daladier, Mussolini, and Hitler meet in the Brown House at Munich. On the outcome of their conversations hinge the peace of the world. NBC's Max Jordan paces the corridor. This is his story.
While I was covering the Big Four meeting for NBC, I noticed a group of British diplomats late that evening leaning against the staircase railing that led to the conference room. I recognized Sir William Strang of the British Foreign Office immediately. And I asked him if he would help me get a copy of the agreement, which was expected to be released any moment.
I'd be delighted to, Jordan, but look here, you'd better be quick about it. The conference will break up shortly.
I dashed up to the attic where we had our NBC microphone installed and called New York frantically, telling them to stand by for an important announcement. Then I rushed back downstairs. Just as the meeting was breaking up, there was Chamberlain and Daladier and Hitler and Mussolini. All were about to leave the building. And there was Sir William. "Hey," I yelled, "have you got the agreement?" I'm afraid I wasn't very polite this way, addressing a diplomat.
"Oh, it's you, Jordan. Yes, we have the text. We'll distribute them to the press over at the hotel."
"But look here, Sir William. New York is waiting. America is waiting. Couldn't I have my copy now?"
"Now? Oh, well, I don't see why not. Here you are."
I grabbed the paper, dashed back upstairs to my NBC mic under the roof, and went on the air with my story.
Thus, Max Jordan and NBC scooped the world with the full text of the agreement that Neville Chamberlain and most of the world believed to be the guarantee of peace. Peace in our time from Munich.
On the night of August 31st, 1939, Germany started the world conflagration. That night will ever remain vivid in the memory of us Americans, correspondents stationed in Berlin. One tip-off that more than a war on Poland was planned by Germany's intuition corporal came to me shortly before midnight. "This conflict will mean the end of the British Empire," said Erich Schneider, Berlin correspondent for the Essener Nationalzeitung, Goering's mouthpiece. His colleague, Hermann Kind, added another thought. "We National Socialists can't understand why our Führer is still negotiating," he complained. "We thought he'd strike just as soon as Ribbentrop came back from Moscow with our pact with Stalin." The Nazi party evidently knew that their chieftain was planning to make war. They can hardly have been unaware of the address Hitler had delivered 9 days previously before his commanding generals, in which he unfolded his plans for world conquest. I went to bed long after midnight. I was awakened again at 6 a.m. by our night desk man, who read me Hitler's order to the Wehrmacht to pour into Poland. Soon the telephone rang. The Foreign Office asked me to report at 8:30 for a Reichstag session. Hitler had the audacity there to register utter surprise at what he called Polish aggression and to swear vengeance. Surprised though he was, he and his immediate entourage wore brand new, elegantly fitted, carefully tailored suits, which were not military uniforms, but party uniforms changed to field gray from the customary brown. The war with Poland was on. It was a blitzkrieg waged with Schrecklichkeit. In a month, it was all over. Some people may have been misled by the lull that followed Polish defeat. The military operations of the ensuing winter were often dubbed the phony war. We in Berlin knew better. As we traveled about the country, we saw Hitler's soldiers everywhere, preparing, drilling, maneuvering, in anticipation of the coming war in the West. And everywhere we saw the entire energies of the nation devoted to producing the implements for a global war.
That was Louis Lochner speaking from Hollywood. He covered Germany until the Nazis did declare war on the United States. NBC's reporter W.W. Chapman was in Europe, too. He will tell you how and why the Germans won at first and then began inevitably to lose.
During the 5 years of this Second World War, I've followed the news through more than a dozen foreign countries, and I've become more or less a collector of last-ditch defenses, defense lines. I think the two which impressed me most were the French Maginot Line and the Russian Volga Line, partly because they were so different, partly because they offered such perfect examples as to just what does and does not make a defense line impregnable. I was in France, attached as an American war correspondent to the British Expeditionary Force, the Dunkirk Army. I was there when France gambled everything on the Maginot Line. And you know what happened to the Maginot Line. I was in Russia during the Battle of Stalingrad and saw the Volga Line hold. Defense is now the exclusive preoccupation of the Germans. It seems to me that we ought to be able to gauge their chances for a successful, even a protracted, though finally vain attempt to stand on the Rhine behind the Siegfried Line. We can judge that from what happened in France and in Russia. And here's what did happen. The Maginot Line was the greatest system of fortifications, the greatest line of defense, physically, ever built. Its very greatness defeated it, because the French army, the French people, were so sure of its impregnability that, in effect, they went to sleep behind it. It was an inanimate defense. The French made the mistake of placing their faith in concrete and steel. The Russians made no such mistake, or at any rate didn't make it at Stalingrad. The Germans did smash through the Stalin line to the west. That also was inanimate. But by the time they reached the Volga, the Russians had seen the light. They had realized that the only truly impregnable defense is composed of the blood and bone and spirit of a people. And at Stalingrad, the blood and bone and spirit of the Russians were impregnable without benefit of steel and stone. Behind the Siegfried Line is an army, a people, who have been shown very plain writing on the wall. Steel and stone cannot save them. I don't think they have the spirit left to save themselves.
As the Nazis burst from Germany and overran Europe, east and west, it became increasingly evident that these United States could not stay long separated from the Holocaust that threatened the world. Some far-sighted citizens had recognized this fact early in the game. Morgan Beatty, who speaks to you now from Washington, tells a story to remember.
The impact of global war did not strike the American mind in full force until Pearl Harbor Day. Washington, with few exceptions, was no better off than anybody else. We simply didn't get it, and we wouldn't listen carefully when people tried to tell us. They were alarmists. I remember the dilemma that this state of mind presented to one American over in the State Department, one Secretary of State Cordell Hull. So on Pearl Harbor Day, my mind flashed black 3.5 years to the summer of 1938, just before Munich, when Hitler was double-talking and throwing his shadow across every boundary in Europe, when the Japanese were denying they were bent on war, yet were still pecking their way toward the Holocaust. Events and signs were multiplying very fast in that summer of 1938, so fast I wondered whether Judge Hull had them all tabbed in his mind, whether he had a focus on the double talk and the confusion generated by the Axis powers. So I asked him for an interview, a private interview. Tonight I can tell the full import of what he said to me on that dramatic summer day. In a short half hour, he told me how difficult it was for a man in his position to sit across the table from the ambassadors of Germany and Japan and have them, through cautious double talk, speak to him with the peep sights of millions of rifles pointing directly at him and through him at all peoples, including our own American people. All people, in fact, who stood in their path or might stand in it. Mr. Beatty, he said, I'm convinced that these two nations have staked out vast areas of the world for themselves. They are planning to erect signs on the ocean's highways of the world, signs marked no trespassing. And when the time comes, they're going to shoot at anybody they please on the highways of the world. They will be satisfied with nothing less than world domination. They have no regard for law nor justice. They think they know where they're going. But, Mr. Secretary, I said, why can't you speak out? He gave me a look that almost defied description. He couldn't prove anything by a mere image in his mind. But the image Secretary Hull planted in my mind on that summer day in 1938 had already etched itself in. Millions of rifles in the hands of millions of Germans and Japanese, who themselves, some of them, did not fully realize the international banditry they were about to commit. Millions of guns that Secretary Hull couldn't prove were there. I told the story then, part of it, and people, well, they sort of shrugged it off. It was not until Pearl Harbor Day that millions of Americans, without guns enough on their shoulders, understood clearly what Judge Hull had seen in 1938. Facts that the British had brought home to them also almost too late.
Yes, long before Pearl Harbor, the British had brought home to them the violent facts of war, which we were to know later. And in those first days after Pearl Harbor, we looked to Great Britain as the one stalwart fortress from which Europe must one day be liberated. Robert St. John, during the past 5 years, has covered all of the European war. He reported to us at that time news of the battle temper of this England and stories of those Britons who fought on.
When I think back on 5 years of war, I think of a curly-haired little girl in a Greek hospital with her arm blown off, crying not because of the pain, but because she wanted her mother, who was dead. When I think of war, I think of roads in many a country packed with homeless refugees wandering they knew not where. I think of the island of Corfu, where the whole population lived in catacombs under their city, not seeing the light of day from one week to the next. War is many memories, but there's one rather good picture which was indelibly stamped on my mind. The picture of a man we called Old Tom. That's all, just Old Tom. He worked at a bench beside mine in a war factory on the edge of London while I was over there for NBC. White-haired, stoop-shouldered Tom, who wasn't very happy because, you see, he was helping to make commando knives, hundreds of them a day, ugly little blades, to be used in killing Nazi guards quietly, silently, in the dead of night. Old Tom wasn't happy at that job because, since he was a boy, he'd been making swords, handsome swords for famous generals, swords which had been carried in half a dozen wars. Sometimes he'd spent months fashioning a single blade. It was one of Old Tom's swords that Lord Kitchener wore when he went to his death. But making commando knives, hundreds of them a day, assembly line fashion, that wasn't the kind of work for a man with pride in his soul. Still, it had to be done. This was war, and the commandos were Britain's first attempt at taking the offensive. And so Old Tom labored on and didn't complain, except that his tired eyes had lost their twinkle. And then one day they called Old Tom into the front office. They told him that Britain wanted to present a fancy sword to the people of Stalingrad as a British tribute to the magnificent defense of their city. It was to be the fanciest, the handsomest sword any man had ever made. And Old Tom had been picked to make it. Perhaps you remember how Winston Churchill presented that sword to Joseph Stalin at the Tehran Conference. It was a great piece of workmanship. And if the people of Stalingrad were proud of it, their feeling was as nothing compared to the pride of its maker. Today, Old Tom is back at some assembly line job again, back putting sharp edges on knives or bayonets. But the twinkle is in his eyes again. He's happy because once more, once during this war, he's had his chance to make a real sword. Old Tom is one of the fine people of Britain. I just hope that he lives to see the peace, to see that day when steel blades shall be something for generals to wear on dress parade rather than ugly little instruments to carve up men's bodies as they are today.
In late 1941, in the first 8 months of 42, Great Britain, almost alone, shouldered the fighting burden of free and occupied Europe. And yet even then, the so-called conquered nations were regirding. No greater testimony of the invincible spirit of the occupied nations can be found than that in France, of the French soldiers who found at last in the first Allied offensives the chance to vindicate the honor of their nation. John Vandercook bears witness.
It was May 12, 1944. I had been in the line all night. Now, at 8 in the morning, I was wandering along a narrow Italian road, not too sure of my whereabouts or my destination. Hello, what is it? A jeep bearing the tricolor insignia of France had pulled up beside me. A young 6-foot French officer had called out to me.
Monsieur, you are an American war correspondent?
Yes.
Perhaps you would like to come to the French sector with me?
I'd like to very much.
Come along then, monsieur.
He asked me if I understood the strategic situation. I did. The Americans were near the coast where the hills dropped away to the sea. Two French divisions were farther inland in the mountains. It was to be their task to capture a series of almost impossibly difficult Nazi positions. If they were successful, Cassino and the Liri Valley would be outflanked. The way would then be open for a general advance of the Allied armies. Up the mountain, we drove in our jeep, ever closer and closer to the German guns, until at last even a jeep could climb no higher. Dirty white tapes marked a 2-foot path through the minefields. We started to climb up. The way was so steep, one supported oneself by touching the path ahead with one's hands. Several times I intercepted from my escort a backward, sardonic look. At last, we were just below the summit, within rifle fire of enemy positions. There, a French colonel was directing the attack on the ridge above us. There, in the glare of the hot sunshine, men were dying with prodigal extravagance, with an almost unnatural calm.
Sylvain de Cook, this is Monsieur Colonel, commandant of our regiment.
How do you do, sir?
Enchanté, monsieur.
He was introduced to me as quietly and elegantly as if we were attending a tea party. And as we crouched there beneath the rain of bullets and shells, I finally charged my captain with what I imagined was the correct interpretation of his look and manner. The look and manner he had made no attempt to conceal from the start of our trip. With an ironic dignity, he admitted I was right.
Yes, monsieur. You are an American. I am French. Your country has been invincible. Mine defeated. Since the day of that defeat, my country has been regarded by many with contempt and scorn. My France. But even among the ashes of defeat, the spirit of France was again reborn. This, I confess, is a dangerous sector. I brought you here today so that you might see how my countrymen face that danger, that you, an American, might witness that spirit.
Yes, I saw the spirit he spoke of. Nowhere else in any combat zone have I ever seen such nerveless, easy courage as those Frenchmen showed that day high in the Italian mountains. The Germans in their concrete pillboxes had flamethrowers, every weapon in the modern arsenal. The French had rifles, grenades, and guts. While I watched, every officer in a regiment was killed. Yet the French assault on the Nazi forts that day broke the back of the Gustav Line and began the northward Allied march through Italy. General Alexander described it as the most remarkable success of the whole offensive. Yes, at that hour and place, I witnessed, I believe, the beginning of the redemption of the reputation of France.
The actions in North Africa and Italy, however, were but preludes to the greater and final action, the invasion of the Atlantic Wall, Hitler's so-called invincible fortress. Mindful of this fact, NBC, more than 2 years ago, concentrated its greatest news staff in the British Isles. One of the veterans of that staff was, and is, Stanley Richardson. He speaks to you now from London.
This is Stanley Richardson at Supreme Allied Headquarters in London. You should go back more than 2 years for the full story of the invasion of northern France and the progress of the Allied armies of liberation on the continent. Because it was just about that time that the first American troops and the first American bomber squadrons arrived in Britain. The Canadians already were here in strength, and the British were regrouping and rearming for another crack at the Germans after their humiliating defeat at Dunkirk. We knew that the big show was on, but it was only a question of time until the first Allied assault units would be crossing to the continent, and that NBC correspondents would be along with them. As we watched and reported the steadily swelling concentration of men, weapons, and supplies here on this little island, as we broadcast about the mounting weight of our bombing attacks on enemy territory, our correspondents were in the field, training along with our troops for D-Day, flying with our aviators on bombing missions, arranging radio transmission facilities against the time when they would be used to report to the American people that the liberation of Hitler-enslaved Europe had begun. All that training, all that detailed planning produced expected results, although not without tragic loss to NBC. Brilliant and courageous Tom Traynor of the Los Angeles Times, who was also NBC's special representative, was killed in action in France. But men like NBC's Wright Bryan, Ed Hocker, and others were the first reporters back here to broadcast about how they watched the Allied landings in Normandy. And NBC veterans like John McVane, Merrill Muller, and David Anderson stuck with our troops in the field. They are still there. And Muller is the only American radio correspondent permitted to cover General Eisenhower's headquarters. These are some of the tangible results of the planning for the biggest radio news reporting job in history, the epilogue that is not yet finished to that period when we watched here in Britain the buildup of Allied military might for the spring across the Channel. This is Ed Hacker, also speaking in London. For my part, I can say a lot has happened since that day we hopped across the Channel. And not only in the 94 days that have passed since then, but in all the 9 months and a few days since I landed at that port, identified only as somewhere in the United Kingdom.
Now, with the buzz bomb menace apparently a thing of the past, with the lights in London scheduled to go on again in 10 days, and with our armies in France forging mighty gains against a beaten enemy, drawing closer and closer to Germany itself, well, putting it mildly, there are more interesting days ahead. And not the least of these will be the complete liberation of France and the Low Countries by British, Canadian, and American armies in the north, rapidly approaching the point where a juncture with Allied armies driving up from the Mediterranean will present Hitler with still another dilemma.
This is Max Hill in Rome. Allied forces are ready to smash into Germany from the south, just north of the Swiss border, and in the region of the Belfort Gap. The Germans are running so fast in southern France that a junction of the north and south Allied armies wasn't even necessary. We are going to drive into Germany itself. Time is running out for Hitler, and winter weather, not the Germans, may be our biggest obstacle. The Japanese come next. 33 months ago today, Japanese gendarmes raided my Tokyo home. I spent the next 6 miserable months in a tiny prison cell and was deported from Japan as a criminal. For the last 9 months, I have been in Italy and Turkey, watching the Allies build up the war machine that has smashed Germany's army in the West. Japan's turn is coming. Don't be impatient. It takes time to prepare an offensive. Think how long it was before we crossed the English Channel. But when we did, the Germans didn't have a chance. Neither will the Japanese.
This is Robert McCormick in Honolulu. As nearly as we can judge out here, this is the beginning of the end of the war in Europe. But we have not yet reached the end of the beginning in the Pacific. We have an enormous amount of fighting yet to do out here. True, the Japs have lost scores of priceless island bases, but they're still hanging on to scores of others, and their homeland is intact. But there's no doubt that the war out here will flare up violently before very long. First, we'll get the preliminaries over with, then we'll settle down to the grim business of closing in on the main part of the Jap Empire. We'll have a full-scale war in the Pacific. It will cease to be a matter of quick airstrikes and swift invasions of small islands. It will be big-time fighting, bloody and strenuous. It will be a difficult war to cover because it will still be scattered. The old business of the tremendous distances in the Pacific will still haunt us. But sooner or later, you'll be hearing NBC broadcasts that'll come to you for thousands of miles across the Pacific. Broadcasts coming more or less directly from battlefronts almost halfway around the world. NBC correspondents will be riding with our magnificent fleet, and they'll be moving with our powerful land forces. They'll be ducking shells in all sorts of strange places. There may be broadcasting facilities in weird spots that have before scarcely been grazed by the type of civilization that exists in continental Europe. But the future of our country will be fought out in these remote corners. We're all quite properly steamed up about the possibilities of a collapse of Nazi Germany. But we'll still have a war of terrifying proportions on our hands when Germany falls on her face, as she must. The fighting will be just as terrible, the battles just as costly, the results just as important. This is Robert McCormick in Honolulu, switching you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is the NBC newsroom in New York. Tonight we have told you stories from 5 years of war. You all know that familiar NBC signature, the 3 chimes that ring at the end of every regular NBC broadcast. But remember that when you hear this one, that extra chime, the 4th chime, means news of the greatest world importance. The 4th chime rang on D-Day. The 4th chime will ring again on V-Day, the day of victory. On this program, H.V. Kaltenborn, Max Jordan, John Vandercook, Robert St. John, Louis Lochner, W.W. Chaplin, Morgan Beatty. Also from overseas, Stanley Richardson, John McBain, Max Hill, and Robert McCormick. And this is Don Goddard.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.